From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made later this month from April 24th through the 26th in downtown Rochester. The New York Statewide Preservation Conference will be hosted by the Landmark Society with a broad range of subjects. Who's eligible for historic rehab tax credits? We talk about right-sizing cities, but how do we determine what the right size really is? How do we revitalize downtown Rochester or even small towns? How should we handle urban neighborhoods or opera houses or main streets, especially when we've got historic buildings and structures involved? Well, joining us for the hour, Caitlin Mivas, who is a preservation planner with the Landmark Society. Caitlin, nice to see you.
Glad to be here.
Larry Francer is the Associate Director of Preservation, which is a lofty title, Larry.
I feel very lofty today.
The Associate Director of Preservation. And we're going to broaden it out because later this hour we're going to hear from more of the participants.
Yeah.
The Little Theater is hosting a documentary. We're going to talk about that. But I want to start with the name of the conference. What's the name of the conference, Larry?
It is called Fill in the Blank, Defining Preservation.
And why did you choose that title?
Because we feel that there are a lot of people who have preconceived notions of what preservation is, and maybe it's something that they just don't relate to. And we want to show people that preservation is a lot of things. So we're saying preservation is blank, fill in the blank.
And it's interesting, when this topic came up among some of our listeners earlier this morning, we heard this interesting dichotomy about what preservation means. You know, some think that preservation means making sure that the historic structures or the important parts of our neighborhood don't get bulldozed or blasted away and for big box stores or fast food chains. Others think that preservation is standing in the way of real development. I'm sure you've heard it all. The Landmark Society.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of our job, my and Larry's job, is trying to correct and guide some of those misperceptions and misconceptions back to reality. So preservation is really a multifaceted field, and it's about helping people, give people the tools to improve their communities. And it's really evolved over the last 20 years to be about revitalization and economic development.
Well, this is a little bit like asking the teacher for the answer on the test question. But Larry, how do you define, if you're filling in the blank on
this? Yeah, I love that question because, I mean, we really looked at all the different things that preservation is. Preservation is neighborhoods. Preservation is development. Preservation is revitalization. And preservation is old-fashioned. I mean, sometimes you have to look at the positive and the negative. Preservation is boring. A lot of people think of it as boring, but preservation is fun. Preservation is now. I mean, our tagline for our 75th anniversary campaign, which we just ended, we're one of the oldest preservation organizations in the country. Our tagline was, it's about now. And preservation isn't really about just old buildings because they're old. We're looking at old buildings because they mean things to people and because they can have a use for the future.
And how do you respond when people say, but that just stands in the way of development and sometimes the bulldozer is necessary for development?
Sometimes the bulldozer is necessary for development. We agree. There are some buildings that can come down. I mean, if they are so far gone, if they have been neglected for so long, and economically, it really is worth taking them down. We're not going to stand, you know, we're not going to put ourselves in front of the bulldozer, you know, activism. We're not going
to do that. Chained to
the building. Right. Sometimes, truly, we agree that there are some buildings that have to come down. But most of the time, people think they have to come down, but they really don't.
They don't. They can be either rehabbed or sort of worked in a new development without total destroy. Give me a sense for what you mean.
Right. I mean, it's typically it is more expensive to tear down a building than to renovate it. And when you're renovating the building, it is, you know, the greenest form of architecture because, you know, you're not, you know, tearing it down, throwing it into a landfill. And when you're renovating it, for the most part, we're looking at adaptive reuse. We're looking at taking buildings and, yes, maybe it was a school building years ago, and maybe the school has moved out. Well, what about senior housing? So, I mean, there are so many uses, and truly, it really, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be cheaper to renovate it than to tear it down.
263-WXXI, 263-9994, to talk about all of these issues related to what communities need and what, you know, what preservation truly means. From April 24th through the 26th, downtown Rochester, there's the New York Statewide Preservation Conference. By the way, Caitlin, where do they get more information on that?
You can go to our website, landmarksociety.org, and get the whole lineup of speakers, schedules, and all the fun events that we're doing.
And it looks like you're kicking off with, we talked about the bulldozer, an event at noon on Thursday the 24th called Bulldoze Your Way to Revitalization. I suspect you're going to say you generally do not successfully bulldoze your way to revitalization, Caitlin.
Yeah, well, the whole point of this talk by our keynote speaker, Donovan Ripkema, is that cities like Rochester and Buffalo that have had massive population loss do need to downsize or right size. But his whole point, and what he's going to be talking about at this luncheon, is that we need to do it strategically. You know, let's not just go in and bulldoze, block, or, you know, randomly demolish houses here and there sporadically, but do it with some kind of plan and strategy in mind.
Give me a sense, Larry, for a structure, or can you point to something that says, boy, I'm glad we didn't knock this down because now it's been repurposed for XYZ?
Let's look at you're putting me on the spot, Evan. and I've only been here a year and a half. I keep saying that. I'm
Caitlin,
the new guy.
You want to be on the spot?
Take it, Caitlin. Let's.
Yeah, well, we've got.
I mean, there are so many buildings.
I think I like to point to the industrial buildings that mm-hmm. are, you know, an integral part of Rochester's history and development and heritage. And a lot of those buildings in the last couple of years have been rehabbed. There's the Carriage Factory building in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood that's being rehabbed right now. And there's going to be more coming online.
I've got one. 44 Exchange.
Yes, a great example of mid-century modern architecture, yeah, which doesn't always get a lot of love.
Well, I thought maybe you guys were going to go right next door to us here. Right next door to us is the old Button Factory, and now it's a nice office building. It also has one of the best coffee shops in the city in Phoenix, and I spend half of my paycheck there. But the neat thing is when you go in, here's what I appreciate, whether it's the Button Factory here in Rochester or Good Luck Restaurant is in the old Fabrics and Findings building. ABVI, I believe, is in sort of a repurposed building. And what mm-hmm. I love seeing is this nod to history with some of the great photos that, you know, 100 years old, 80 years old, et cetera, that you see what you're walking through and you see the bones of the building are still there, whether it's Good Luck Restaurant or elsewhere. I mean, and I find that important. Maybe I'm just a nostalgic
geek. And I think you feel it.
I do,
I think,
yeah,
when you are in these historic buildings, you feel the history. You feel the people who have walked these same halls. I was involved with a big project back in Indiana about tearing a courthouse down. And a courthouse is where, you know, people got married there. People got all these licenses. So there was so much change to people's lives. Mm-hmm. That the thought of not being able to walk those halls and feel that to people who have lived it is, you know, unbelievable. How could that ever happen that I wouldn't be able to go in the building where I got my marriage license?
Yeah.
I mean,
but looking at the local examples we've already cited, you know, Good Luck is an example of a restaurant. There's portrait studios upstairs. There's a lot of different things. That building, the bones, you still feel what it was, but that doesn't mean that economic development has been blocked just because you didn't knock the building down.
Right.
And I know that's an important part of the conversation. Let's bring in our first call, Mike in Rochester. Thanks for calling Connections, Mike.
Oh, yes. The guest said that they're just recently new to Rochester. But Governor Pataki had a program called Sacred Places that was meant to keep churches intact instead of closing churches. Are they familiar with that program?
Caitlin?
I am not. I'm also a relatively recent transplant to Rochester. I've only been here for a couple of years. I'm not familiar with that program, but there is a really great grant program out of New York City from the New York Landmarks Conservancy that provides funding to houses of worship throughout the state. So there is still that, and that's a really important program to a lot of congregations throughout the state.
And there are a lot of churches, again, that are being repurposed. And that's absolutely something we probably get a call at least, you know, once a week from a congregation that is either having to move, downsize, looking for a new place, and
they don't want to see that building knocked down.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think St. Bridget's is a very important building that should be preserved, and that's where Colonel O'Rourke had his funeral, and it's believed that that's the only time Susan B. Anthony was in a Catholic church. So for many reasons, I think there should be efforts to maintain St. Bridget's.
Mike, thanks for calling, and this is a great time to ask the question that Mike's points lead to, which is for communities, whether you're a congregation for a church or workers in a building that's moving or whatever it is, if they have questions, what are the resources that you guys can provide? And I'll start with Caitlin.
Yeah, we can provide a number of resources. We're basically your conduit to information and contacts and funding. So we can put folks in touch with contractors, with architects who specialize in older buildings, with different funding sources, whether it's public, private, and give them ideas and connect them with other projects that can sort of serve as examples.
Larry, how often do you get those kind of calls?
Every day. Yeah. Every single day.
It's emotional for people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And people who are in a historic home, sometimes they feel so overwhelmed, but they care about it so much, they want to get the right contractor, or they've had a problem with a contractor before, and they want to make sure they're getting the right contractor. And we're out on site visits constantly during the week, meeting with organizations, meeting with small towns, meeting with private homeowners and building owners who just want advice. And that's why we're here.
Yeah. I have to say, when I drive down to the Finger Lakes, I pass old barns and I think that should never come down. You're smiling over there, Larry. You with me on that?
Oh, absolutely. And again, coming from Indiana, you know, barns are so important, and there are so many that you're driving that are just, they're just all falling down.
And I know they're dilapidated, but the question becomes then, what can you realistically do with it?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the bottom line in the preservation field when we're having these discussions, whether it's a barn, mm-hmm. a church, what have you, is there an economic use for it?
Yeah.
And if there isn't funding, if there isn't an economic use for it, it becomes really challenging to find a solution.
Well, now you're starting to see what the conference is going to be all about, the 24th through the 26th. And we're just scratching the surface because there's a lot of different facets here. Before I bring in our next guest via phone, who's part of this, let me ask Larry, because we've had questions online. Who is the conference really for? How would you define that?
The conference is for everyone. How about that?
Everyone who cares about a community, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Really. And that's exactly it. If you're interested in making your community, your neighborhood, your small town a better place to live, work, and visit, I mean, that's who should be coming to our conference. I mean, property owners, community advocates, grassroots preservationists, planners, public officials, and that's usually who we have coming. So you'll be in great company. There'll be lots of networking. It's a great place to be.
And Caitlin, where can they find a list of events? Because I know there's a lot going on.
Yeah, if you go to landmarksociety.org/conference, we have a link to ticketing and the full rundown of the schedule, because there is a lot going on.
Let's get through two more quick calls before we get to our cinematographer who's going to be on the line. But first, Jane in Rochester. Jane, thanks for calling.
I believe it was 1982. George C. Scott and Timothy Hutton played the lead roles in TAPS. T-A-P-S. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. TAPS. TAPS. The basics of the movie was conflict over tearing down an old military institution academy and putting in its place a condo. And but you did get the title because it is a good movie, TAPS.
Yeah.
And all the issues you're talking about are covered in that movie. And I feel like our old buildings, our historical buildings, represent landmarks in our identity. And once they're gone, they're gone. Mm-hmm. And nobody comes to Rochester for a McDonald's burger. But they do come for other things like the Eastman House and, like you've covered, Jane,
Well, thanks, Jay. I think that's exactly what Larry and Caitlin are saying, aren't you?
Right. We are shaking our heads.
Yeah, you know, these buildings are economic assets because they attract people and investment.
Yeah, absolutely. Bonnie in Rochester. Thanks for calling, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. A couple things. First of all, glad to hear about your event coming up. One suggestion I would make, and I was glad you mentioned grassroots groups and all, but, you know, just a thought, if you already maybe do this already, is to, a lot of times people, are, believe it or not, are more connected to their neighborhoods and sometimes don't venture too much beyond that. So having events that go to some of the neighborhoods, especially the poorer neighborhoods, I would highly recommend. That's number one point. The other point is, this may sound a little gloomy, but I wonder, every once in a while I see posted downtown, you know, pictures of the old Rochester, but it would be great to have some kind of event where you actually took the major buildings that had hotel, had a lot of visual interest and all that, and had pictures of them, you know, big enough so people could identify with it, and just to see where they were, just to see, you know, collectively what the impact was. Because I think people often, you know, if they know a particular place, well, yes, I know that was a good place, but they don't necessarily always put it together. Again, especially I'm thinking people who aren't always involved with these kinds of issues, but probably could be you know, made of more interest. And the other thing quickly is that I think people also don't quite understand how transportation issues are so critical for both maintaining cities in terms of how you want cities to be walkable and also how development is often connected to transportation. So thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie. I see Caitlin and Larry scribbling. Go ahead, Caitlin.
Well, I wanted to mention the neighborhoods thing. On Saturday the 26th, we do have a couple of field sessions that are going to take place throughout the city that are going to highlight some individual adaptive reuse projects downtown, as well as some neighborhood efforts. We'll have a field session in the South Wedge. We'll have one at Genesee Valley Park.
We'll have one right here in High Falls.
In High Falls, that's right. Thank you. And tied to the neighborhood thing, too, we are also offering conference scholarships for folks who want to help defray the cost of registration, and we are particularly trying to target folks who are involved in city neighborhoods. So get in touch with us if you're involved in your neighborhood and want to check out the conference.
Right, and that's thanks to the Daisy Markey Jones Foundation, those scholarships. We're really, really pleased that we can offer those. And a great student rate thanks to the foundation as well.
All right, I'm going to bring in Andrew Garrison if we can here. He is the director and cinematographer and co-editor of Third Ward TX, Texas.
Third Ward, Texas.
It's a documentary that's going to be showing at the Little Theater during the conference. Is that right? 24th through the 26th conference. When can we see Third Ward?
Yes, Thursday the 24th, we'll be having the film at the Little Theater at 7 p.m. And tickets are available at our website. If you purchase conference registration, it's included. But if you want to just come to the film, you can do that too.
Andrew Garrison, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Great, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Tell us what Third Ward, Texas is all about.
Well, it's really the story of Project Row Houses, which is an arts organization that got started in the Third Ward of Houston, inner city Houston. It got started by a group of seven local artists, all of whom wanted to do something of benefit for their community. And what that turned out to be was actually a kind of creative redevelopment with art as the engine of change.
And how did they I was fascinated just watching the trailer and reading up on it. How did they use their art?
They were all students of a man named John Biggers. He taught at Texas Southern. And Biggers' emphasis was always on the domestic, on the local, on community. And they looked around and they saw two blocks of little shotgun houses that were had been built and were abandoned, essentially. They were now crack houses, shooting galleries, and there was prostitution. And the first thing they did was board up those houses, pick up the glass, and paint pictures on the boarded up doorways and windows as a drive-by exhibition. It actually really began with talking to neighbors and saying, you know, we want to do some political art. And the neighbors, particularly this one 88-year-old woman, Mrs. Courtney, said, "That's nice, honey, that you want to do something political, but what we need is the junkies out of here and the glass picked up." So that's where it began.
And that's what they wanted, but maybe art, maybe you can accomplish both. What happened?
Well,
without giving away the story, Andrew, but what happened next?
The rest of the story. With a very small grant, an NEA $35,000 individual artist grant, they were able to secure these two blocks of houses, and they converted five of those houses into housing for single mothers who are going back to college, and six other houses as exhibition spaces for local artists and artists who would come in on a biannual basis to put whatever they want in the house as an exhibition. They made it a center where people would want to come. You know, it was a campus where they could see art, where they could make art. There were after-school classes for kids. There was weekend classes. And it became a kind of a locus for both for art and for community.
And Andrew, for our listeners who just jumped in here, Third Ward, Texas happens in what town?
It happens in Houston, Texas.
Houston, Texas. So I want to bring in Larry and Caitlin back to the conversation because any city in America, most communities in America, people can relate to a bad neighborhood, boarded up houses, crack houses, and the question of what do we do with that? Now, Rochester's had that. So why do you think this idea travels so well, Larry?
I think it's the community aspect of it. Watching the film, it was so heartwarming to see, yeah, the art was great and it was surely the catalyst, but the single moms and the opportunities that they get by living there, the community that was created within the Project Row House, but then bringing in the community all around them, it was just amazing to watch it.
I mean, my sense from watching the film is that it really became a rallying point for the community and a play, you know, something to really get behind and increase pride and something to really for the community to really focus on and really to build up their neighborhood.
And any preservation project has to have community support.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the perfect story of, you know, taking these, you know, shotgun houses and restoring them and, you know, making something of the neighborhood. It's not just about restoring the old homes. It's about what it does for the neighborhoods and to the neighborhoods.
Andrew, when you got involved, how far along was this project?
It had already been ongoing for about 8 years. Kind of came late.
Yeah, and so how much buzz about it was there? I mean, I imagine this is the – every community wants a success story like this, but not every community has one.
Well, you know, it wasn't exactly a perfect success story in that, you know, it's not, you know, they still look for funding, they still look for support, they're still trying to make things happen, and they, other issues occur. It's a kind of a moving target as things keep on going. They make certain kinds of changes and improvements, and then other things pop up. For example, one of the things that's documented in the film, they were successful in doing these things, cleaning up the neighborhood, making it a stimulating, interesting place to live once again. It used to be that, and they returned that and brought new life to the neighborhood, which made it a more attractive place for developers to come. And
right.
The very people who are benefiting from this development in the neighborhood by Project Row Houses now are threatened by commercial development coming in. So that became another issue for them.
You know, what an interesting point that is. And, you know, Larry and Caitlin, how often do we see that? We see something that's sort of a community need. You find a way to preserve and revitalize, and all of a sudden it almost gets out of control or it is so successful that it may threaten part of the integrity of where it once stood.
Yeah, you know, you almost become a victim of your own success. I mean, everyone wants to see property values either stabilize or grow and, you know, wants to see the neighborhood be a safe and enjoyable community. And I think the key is really to keep the community, the folks who live in the neighborhood and are invested in it, to keep them involved and engaged in the process of development and planning for their own community.
And gentrification has gotten a bad rap. I mean, we used to use it as a positive word, and now it's definitely looked on as a negative word. But there isn't anything wrong with bringing other development in as long as it doesn't displace the community that's there. And I think Project Row House, I mean, I think they dealt with it very well, and it looked like, at least watching the film, that they were dealing with it and they were, you know, buying up some property themselves and developing it. And that's what it takes.
Andrew, stay there for one more second. I want to get one more quick caller in here before the break here. Let's let's get John and Henrietta on. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Yeah, so used to live in the city and saw a lot of the houses. gradually fall into disrepair and become problem properties, more of a liability to the city. And I thought of the idea of, as houses are condemned, to gradually, in a sort of checkerboard fashion, turn those areas into green space, community gardens that could be gradually converted into larger and larger areas, with people in those communities having access to that, you know, more green space and more community gardens, that kind of thing.
Let's start with Caitlin. Go ahead, Caitlin.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an option for neighborhoods where there is not as strong an economy and a lot of vacancy. But I think the key to that, going back to our luncheon topic for Thursday the 24th, is to make sure it's strategic and done in some kind of intelligent manner.
Yeah, and I mean, Donovan deals with that very well. I mean, you really don't checkerboard. You don't want to have missing teeth.
Yeah.
You know, yes, it's great maybe to, at the end of a block, see that, you know, there can be some nice green space and maybe a community garden. But when you start, you know, pulling out teeth in the middle of the streetscape, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, and I John and Henrietta, thanks for the call. I'd love to wrap up with Andrew on that point. You know, Andrew in Rochester, and again, Andrew on the phone is the director and cinematographer of Third Ward, Texas, a documentary that's going to be showing at the Little later this month. Exactly to Larry's point, you saw Houston, Texas, do something a little differently, and they're having some success. I mean, it's not perfect, but they have some success. I talk to people all the time, Andrew, in Rochester, who say, boy, I'd rather just bulldoze that house than try to do something with it because it's a sore spot on the street, but the rest of the street's kind of okay. How much do you think that debate about just knocking them down comes up in these communities?
Well, I couldn't say how much it comes up, but, you know, the thing that Project Row Houses did was kind of follow bigger principles that John Biggers laid out. You know, he had like six principles, and the first one was that there should be architecture in a community that's good and relevant, you know, relevant to the environment, relevant to the population. And the second is that art and creativity has to be there as a means of survival. You know, people in those neighborhoods used to make their own clothes. They decided add-ons to the housing. They redesigned their landscape. All of that is part of making an environment that's exciting and stimulating, and it's connected to the people who are there. So they were very interested, Project Row Houses, in reconnecting that creative spirit to the community that's there. The third thing was education, community education, kind of informal education, whether that's through after-school classes or whether that's musical classes or, you know, all kinds of different ways in which youth participate and adults participate together. And then there's got to be both a social safety net and economic development, you know, and I think those are among the hardest things because you know, you can do good things, but at the same time, how do you stimulate the economy in a way that, you know, is beneficial to that neighborhood and keep it going? And I think they've actually done a great job. That very thing that you pointed out about buying up some space around the neighborhood, they have been building low-cost housing. Some of it is for rent. Some of it is for sale. It's in the vernacular of the kind of architecture that exists there. It's not strange. There's porches, you know, which is the tradition, and so, you know, people can actually meet each other. The houses face each other. They're close to each other so that there's a lot of interaction between people. All of these things are ways in which, you know, they're both stimulating the economy and they're also, through the architecture, helping to create community.
Andrew, we'll see the film at the Little later this month. Where can people check out the trailer?
They can go to thirdwardtx.org, and they can see the trailer there.
The director of Third Ward, Texas, Andrew Garrison, on the phone with us. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much, and I hope you all enjoy it. It sounds like a great conference.
All right, very
Thanks.
Good.
Thanks, Andrew.
We'll see you later this month. And once again, Caitlin, his film, Third Ward, Texas, shows when?
Thursday, April 24th at the Little Theater at 7 p.m., and tickets are available on our website, landmarksociety.org.
If you're just joining us this hour, we're talking about this event, the New York Statewide Preservation Conference, and we're talking to both Larry Francer, who's the Associate Director of Preservation with the Landmark Society. Caitlin Mivas is a preservation planner. And Larry has been keeping me on the straight and narrow with the name of the conference. The name of the conference is...
Fill in the blank, defining preservation.
That's what we're talking about this hour. Whether, as I've said, you drive past an old barn or you've got a church that you want to make sure doesn't get knocked down, houses on your street or historic buildings in your community, all of those things are in play. When we come back, we're going to take a very, very short break, and we're going to talk about sneaky preservation and the impact of emotion. We've got a guest who's going to join us by phone next, and we'd love your phone calls as well. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'm Evan Dawson, and you're listening to member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. As Larry points out, as the Little Theater often does when you bring a documentary in, they often bring in people to talk about it, and the Little will be bringing in someone to talk about Third Ward, Texas, right, Larry?
Yeah, we've got one of the producers coming up from New York, and she will be in. We're actually having a wonderful cocktail reception beforehand, which is a separate ticketed item at the Sagamore, a great example of infill in the East End. Beautiful, beautiful building that was built new but fits in perfectly with the streetscape. And she'll be at that cocktail reception. She will be at the film. And then she'll be at the dessert reception that all the folks who come to the film get to walk over to Tuvine and have a dessert reception, which is really nice.
Well, so let me just hit a couple of plugs here because there's a lot coming up on Thursday the 24th. First of all, on Connections, Neil deGrasse Tyson's coming on the show. So that's a big day for Connections on Thursday the 24th. Yeah. And that's the start of the three-day conference that we're talking about here that starts with that luncheon at noon on the 24th, but then all of the information, all the events you can check out. And Caitlin Mivas, tell us what we're online. They can check out the schedule of events.
Go to our website, landmarksociety.org/conference, and check it all out.
And if for anybody who's ever had a debate in their community about, I can't believe they're knocking down this building, I can't believe this is going to do this, or this schoolhouse, or whatever it is, we've all been there. And if you just joined us, Larry made the point earlier in the hour that the Landmark Society is not about standing in front of every bulldozer and, you know, chaining yourself to a building and refusing to allow development. It's about asking us to make good decisions about development. It's about honoring history, but also understanding how you weave development into that. I think all of those things are important, and we can relate to that. And someone who can relate to that is Dana Saylor Furman. I want to bring her into the conversation. Dana Saylor Furman is the principal of Old Time Roots Historic Research Services, and there's a session at the conference coming up called Sneaky Preservation, Making Advocates Through Emotional Experience with Place. Dana, nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
First of all, tell us what Old Time Roots Historic Research Services is.
Well, I'm located here in Buffalo, New York, and I provide historic property research for private owners and commercial businesses. That can include everything from just an interesting house history to information that can be applied to a National Register nomination for a building, architectural surveys, and other things like that. I contribute my historic research services to those types of things as well.
And let me ask our in-studio guests, when is her session coming up at the conference?
So Dana's going to be presenting with a couple of other folks on Friday, April 25th, during our classroom-style breakout sessions, and she's going to be late morning at 10:45 to 11:45, and it should be a really cool session.
So we've been defining, Dana, we've been defining preservation. How would you define sneaky preservation?
Well, sneaky preservation is a term that I've been using for the idea that I've really learned over the last couple of years through my involvement with both the preservation movement and creative placemaking. Now, for those who don't know, creative placemaking is basically when you take something creative like the arts and you put it in a place that is disinvested or forgotten or threatened in some manner, and you revitalize that place through the artistic medium. And that is a lot of what they were discussing also with Third Ward, Texas.
Absolutely.
You know, they're doing artistic interventions that relate to the community, that bring the community in, and that gives the community what they need and also helps artists and helps the entire city through that process.
And
so
you,
basically,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dana. Go ahead.
Yeah, so sneaky preservation is kind of what I've learned because I've done the thing where you stand in front of a building with a sign and you try to, launch into court cases and you try to quote statistics on camera. And that sometimes works and it sometimes doesn't. But what I have realized is that through my event City of Night that I planned with my group, Emerging Leaders in the Arts Buffalo, it's at Abandoned Grain Elevators in Buffalo. It's a one-night pop-up arts installation event in the old First Ward on the Buffalo River. And we've had tremendous growth in that event over the last 3 years because people want to get inside these places. They're incredible. They're iconic. They're meaningful for a variety of reasons. And sometimes they're even abhorred because they're seen as, a symbol of our decline as a city. But people are still really curious about them. And so they come and they experience art installations and food trucks and live music and performance and all this stuff, and they walk away with a transformed vision of themselves, the city, the place, and that is what's sneaky. It turns them into advocates. It's really an amazing process.
Dana Saylor Furman is on the phone with us from Buffalo, who's been working on this issue and these kind of events for Buffalo, but we're in Rochester, Dana. You talk in general about those kind of events. Give me another specific example, even if it's not Rochester, but give me another example of what you're talking about.
This kind of thing can happen anywhere. There's been a lot of positive development, for example, in Pittsburgh. They've done waterfront trails and connective opportunities to businesses there. And there's artwork along the way, and people kind of stop and experience the place. And sometimes the art is just in the way that things are developed. It doesn't necessarily have to be fine artists going in and transforming a space, but creative practice is at the heart of this idea, so that you are incorporating the work of creative minds. Pittsburgh, as we know, has beautiful geography, and it's a lovely city. And I think that, when you connect all the waterfronts, people are able to get these vistas, see some art along the way. I was just in Indianapolis for the conference, and Larry's familiar with that, obviously, for the National Preservation Conference last November. And there, they also have a trail that connects various artistic areas of the city, and it's bikeable and walkable, and people can experience that, galleries and different spaces as they come up along that trail. So, all of these things, whether they're one-night events or whether they're ongoing planning activities, are all, in effect, preservation.
Stay there, Dana. I want to broaden the conversation with our guests in studio, and if our listeners want to join the conversation, you can do that, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Because, Larry and Caitlin, part of the point of bringing people together for this conference later this month is making sure they're aware, as Dana talks about, aware of the options, how to go about preservation, and sometimes it's people might not realize that there are historic rehab tax credits or those kind of things. What's out there for those who've never gotten involved with this kind of thing, Caitlin?
Yeah, so there's the fun events like Dana's talking about, the more sneaky events, and then there's also practical resources like the rehab tax credits that are available to private homeowners as well as commercial developers, and there is some limited grant funding out there, like the Sacred Sites Program for religious properties that I talked about earlier.
Dana, I also want to ask you about just the power of emotion, because you talk about kind of sneaky emotion. It's bringing somebody in, experiencing something, and all of a sudden they love it, they're invested in it, they want to see it preserved. How valuable is emotion in driving so much of preservation? And we've been talking about that the whole hour. I mean, to me, that seems like it's the central part. I mean, Larry asked what preservation is. Preservation is often about emotion and preserving mm-hmm. history and the emotion of history.
Right. I would say that an emotional connection is absolutely essential. I mean, if you look at any volunteer group, if you look at any community that's successful, if you look at any event in the nonprofit group or the whatever group behind it that's throwing the event, there's love for that place, for that experience. And so, when people were leaving City of Night and they were saying to me, I'm an architect. I don't normally get out to gallery openings. It's not really my thing or my milieu, but here I find myself with this experience with art all around me, and I'm really thinking about this quite differently. And in fact, I might even submit something next year as an installation. You know, that tells me that there's a transformative power in that experience of place, and that, you know, you really have to have people believe in it, care about it, and be, like you said, invested in it in order to move whatever agenda you might have for that place forward and to continue its rehabilitation, its reinvestment.
Christina in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm close to a lifetime resident of Rochester, and as I was listening to the show, I thought of several buildings that had been repurposed, and I don't know whether the Landmark Society had ever been involved with them or not, but they have been quite successful, and they have stood the test of time. And one that I wanted to mention was back in the 70s, a number of city schools had to be closed according to the school board, and there was a lot of furor, as there always is when something like that takes place. One of them happens to be on Linden Street on the east side of town, and it was very successfully rehabilitated into apartments and or condos, I believe. And I have a bachelor friend who's lived there over 20 years, and I have friends who are a senior couple who were downsizing who live there, and it offers everything that they want.
But Christina, can I ask you a question, Christina?
Sure.
Because Larry made the important point earlier this hour that it's almost always more expensive to knock a building down and build something in its place than it would be mm-hmm. to rehab it. So that's an important starting point for a conversation about rehab. But if there's going to be an emotional attachment to, okay, that's an old schoolhouse. I went to school there. I don't want to see it knocked down. But if it becomes an apartment building, is it still recognizable? Are the bones still recognizable? Is the emotional recognition still there?
The bones are still recognizable, and there is still a playground near it. But they expanded on the possibilities, and there's at least the two apartments I've seen, the loft spaces enhance it for residential use. So I think sometimes when these changes happen, they're painful initially, but they can enhance the neighborhood. The other one that I just wanted to mention is the present home for a long time of Hochstein School of Music and Dance. And that was a beautiful and huge church with a long history in Rochester. And again, a number of years ago, Hochstein moved into that building and has not only slowly made improvements, but they have greatly expanded the school. And there's a wonderful, acoustically wonderful performance hall. And it's useful to the whole region. It's not just a city thing, though it is on Plymouth Avenue. So those are just, you know, they maybe probably haven't gotten any great attention in decades in terms of the repurposing of the buildings, but these beautiful buildings that also contain many memories were not torn down in what we used to call urban removal, and they live today as an enhancement to the neighborhood it's in the case of the school, or to downtown in the case of Hochstein. So I just wanted, since I've been here a long time, I remember the you know, some of the prior concerns that went on when these changes were made, and we can't be complacent, but we do need to recognize our successes.
Yeah, it's a great call, Christina. Thanks for making the call. Some reaction from our guests in studio?
Yeah, the schools, whether you're in a small rural community or in the city of Rochester, often do become vacant, and they lend themselves particularly well to adaptive reuse for residential use, whether it's affordable senior housing or a mix of income housing. They lend themselves really well to that kind of use, and you can still preserve some of the character-defining features that give you that feeling and that make it an appealing space.
And when, in fact, they use the federal tax credits, they need to. They typically won't be given the tax credits. They won't be signed off unless they keep some of these features that let you experience what it was before, using, you know, incorporating chalkboards, you know, keeping the hall feeling. They can't just cut it all down and drop the ceilings. I mean, that's what's so wonderful about it.
Yeah, and Dana, that's maybe that's the emotional connection there, you know, and that's why I asked Christina if you could still recognize it as a school building, and she talks about the playground. How important is it that we still can at least get a sense for the previous historical purpose?
Well, I would say that it's pretty important for people to be able to do that, I think. But also, I believe that we all recognize that we're at a point in our as we call them now, legacy cities, where we have a lot of vacancy, and we're going to have to figure out ways to deal with that.
Yeah.
And I think that the reality is that there's going to need to be some repurposing with as much of a nod to the past as we can. I mean, I'm a historian. It's very important to me that we maintain the integrity of our city streets and our rural towns, and that the look and feel of them is generally the same, which is the beauty of that tax credit requirement, as Larry was mentioning. But I think that, I think to have that emotional connection to place, I mean, at least it's still there, you know, is always kind of what I say. If something's been made into something new, at least it's still being used as a building. It's on the tax rolls. It could be changed to another use in the future. When we tear down buildings, as the caller was talking about earlier, for green space, what we lose is density, and not only that, but potential for the future. Because once that building is gone, it's gone forever. We really have to seriously consider.
Dana, one more quick question for you. Can emotion work against you? Can you become so tied to a structure or a building that you're not willing to see what it could be, or even in the cases where it has to go?
You know, it is possible, I suppose, but I think that... what I'd like to say is that we can save any building. It is possible to save any building. The reality is there the funding? Is there the will of both people and the political leadership? And then the answer is not always for everything. So, I mean, I've definitely recognized in my, you know, kind of early on career here as a preservationist and volunteer activist, that, you know, that does not always exist. And so you have to make some difficult choices sometimes, which is what the idea of right-sizing is all about. But it's also, you know, I think that people can get a little clouded on things. And, you know, a lot of times preservationists are called out in the media for wanting to, quote, save everything. But I really don't think that most people believe that that's possible in the real world. But I think that a lot of times, what we do have as a group is vision, and we can see that there are opportunities for things, and we can put together actual economically viable packages for developers to come in and remake a property in a new way. And I think that that's an opportunity that is forgotten sometimes. So
yeah.
We really have to be cognizant.
You talk about that media stigma. It's pretty clear just from the hour here that it's unfair to say that preservationists are anti-development. What do you say if people say, isn't preservation anti-development, Dana?
Well, I say that they are definitely wrong, because almost any preservation person that you talk to understands the need for moving forward, and they see history as a continuum, not just about the past. I believe that a number of us are, you know, all working towards getting a seat at the planning and development table. That's a hugely important part of this whole movement. I think staying relevant requires us to do that, and I think we want to have a voice in the process, we have to get a seat at that table. And it requires us to acknowledge that, you know, some things are going to have to be remade, and once in a while things will be demolished, and sometimes for the wrong reasons. But, you know, it's up to all of us as citizens to band together and be aware of what is happening and why development happens and who benefits from it and whether it's good for the community, and speaking out on its behalf.
And I think we all laugh just like Dana did when you asked her that, and Caitlin and I, we both did.
I asked it purposely just to tee it up. That's called a softball. I don't know too many of those on Connections.
And I think whenever anyone asks us that question, and it's not just you trying to get the conversation going, we hear that question all the time.
That's why I asked it, because I know some people think it.
And I think we all laugh, because we start the answer with a laugh, because it's just not true. And people all see that and think that, but it just isn't. That's not who we are.
Dana, thanks for taking the time. We'll see you in Rochester later this month.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's Dana Saylor Furman with Old Time Roots Historic Research Services. She's based in Buffalo, and she's going to be joining the conversation when, Caitlin?
On Friday, April 24th at our preservation conference at the Little Theater.
All right, so a lot going on. The Little is involved, and as you've heard from some of these seminars to discussions to the documentary at the Little, so much happening later this month. And I want to wrap the conversation with this. Larry, I asked earlier who this is for, and the answer is it's for everybody. But often, if you're not the head of a neighborhood group or you're not an elected office holder, sometimes the average citizen, for the lack of a better word, feels either an intimidation or a hesitation to go out to events like this. Why would you tell them not to hesitate?
Because there are people just like you there. I mean, you may not think so. You may think, you know, you're just interested. You aren't really part of an organization yet. There are other people who are doing it, but you like these buildings. Everyone who is there is going to be supportive. Everyone who is there is going to be will have been at one point in the same position that you're in. And in fact, the way we structured the conference, we do have a Saturday-only registration where if you are working and you can't get the day off because it isn't your quote-unquote job, you can just come on Saturday and hear a great speaker, Ed McMahon, at a wonderful breakfast at the East Avenue Inn & Suites. It's going to be, I think, our two events that we're having there are the first public events that they're having in their new ballroom, the restored ballroom. So it's for everyone, and we want you all to come and join us.
The 24th through the 26th, one more time on the website?
LandmarkSociety.org.
And here's how I know Larry Francer is the real deal when it comes to preservation. He has repurposed and revitalized an awesome bow tie, and I wish our listeners could see it. It is about history and modernity, all in a bow tie. Larry, thank you. It was a great hour.
Thank you, Evan.
Appreciate it. Caitlin, nice meeting you. Nice seeing you here. Thank you very much. And thank you to our listeners. Very active 2 hours today on Connections. Joe Morelli tomorrow in studio. And then we're also talking about maternity and paternity leave. Daniel Murphy and some of the silly comments on Sports Talk Radio. We're not Sports Talk Radio. We're member-supported public radio. See you tomorrow.